Friday and stay till Sunday.
Is the delete all amendment?
It was good.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get back in the
Need to get my agenda.
So were you there at the beginning of this discussion?
Yes. What did I do? Yeah. I just went over.
That's what you went over. Okay.
Morning, everyone. The E12 Finance Division will come to order. Today is Wednesday, April 3, 2013. We have four bills on the agenda. We're going to start with Senate File 1142, Senator Stump. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Here we are, over halfway through the session, and so we're getting pretty serious about what's going to end up coming out of the session. Well, this legislation, I would like to be sure that we offer I have a delete all amendment, and I know that frustrates a lot of people sometimes, but.
Now, Senator Stump offers the A1 amendment. I believe it's been distributed. And for the public, there may be a copy or a pile there. This is the first hearing on the bill, so it's a courtesy to offer the author's amendment so it's in the shape he wishes. All in favor of the A1, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carry. As amended.
Mr. Chairman, just a technical question. Do we have copies for the public or?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, they do. Okay. All right. Great. The proposal before you is a result of several kind of ideas that have come up over the years, and then in particular this last year when we had the education working group that worked all through the summer, or spring and summer last year and into the fall, and came up with a number of suggestions on how we could improve the education funding in our state. This particular piece of legislation centers primarily around reducing property tax levies, education school levies. So it's a narrow slice of what I hope can be part of the education package that comes out of the session. Many of you probably went home for the Easter break, and one of the pieces of mail that you got were your property tax statements for 2013. And that has, I know Warren got my property tax statement and went back to my house and the phone was ringing. People were complaining about the increased property taxes that they had to pay. So there was a reason and why those property taxes have crept up over the last number of years. What this proposal tries to do is to take not only reduce school levies in a number of areas, but also to try to bring in some of the reforms that the Education Working Group came up with. And so what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman and members, is take that one kind of single sheet paper that looks like an outline, and at the top it just says summary of A1 amendment.
Excuse me, Senator Stump, members, we have a lot of paper, but we're referring out to the summary. Okay.
Go ahead. The first bullet there talks about education levies being reduced by a little over $150 million. And then under that, you'll see the levies that we have tackled. And we've looked at those levies for several reasons. But the main reason is that most schools have those levies. We're trying to figure out how we can reduce property taxes in a general, fairly uniform way. So, like the Safe Schools levy, that's reduced. The operating capital levy, is a fairly large levy, $110 million. And a little bit of the history on that is that back in 2005, the operating capital levy, it didn't exist. Operating capital was 100% aid. But when we ran into financial problems back then, we made it into a levy, and you know, to save the state dollars. And so what we're doing here is basically buying that levy back out so that it's going to be in the future aid to the schools. The equity levy, almost $34 million reduced. And then the in this proposal, there is a general education levy that's created, a $20 million education levy, and that's a new creation. So the tax committee, in conjunction with the education committee, wanted to be sure that we have property tax reductions, and they want to do it through the education committee, through the education system. So the $170 million that we started with, we reduced levies basically $150 million and then create a $20 million general education levy. The second bullet is that we, these levies are, and we'll have runs too in a little bit. Once I go through the outline,
yes,
we'll have runs so that you can look through the districts. It varies, it fluctuates a little bit between districts, but it's quite uniform, the reductions across all districts and across throughout the whole state. And that's kind of the bullet, or the point that this bullet makes, is that these levies are affecting all districts across the state of Minnesota. In the Safe Schools levy, there's a handful of districts across the state that does not levy the Safe Schools levy, at least to the max of the $30 per pupil. And so in this proposal, the $30 is converted to aid, and all districts receive it. So it is a new levy or a new aid for those districts. So in the end, the Safe Schools levy is reduced by a little over $29 million. I mentioned that the operating capital levy is virtually reduced to all aid, and the next bullet talks about the equity formula. And here, what was done is the $46 million, or the $46 per pupil, is changed to aid, but that aid is not sent out or not put on to the general education formula amount. There's a new, it's called the basic supplemental revenue. And the basic supplemental revenue is new, and in that it does not drive, it's not linked to all of the other programs. So unlike the general education formula, when we add a dollar to that program, it drives other kinds of expenditures for the state. This does not. So here in this $46 per pupil, it is a dollar for a dollar. So that levy is reduced by almost $34 million. And I mentioned the general education levy of $20 million. Excuse me. And the other component that's in here that sometimes gets more attention than all of the other important things is that, and this is my personal feeling, but I believe it's backed up by some sound reasoning, that we take the alternative teacher compensation program, which has been kind of referred to as QComp. It currently is in the general education portion of the statutes. What I do is I take and lift that out of the general education portion of the statute and set it outside in a different statute. The reason being, if you look on the first page of your bill, general education statute is general to all students, all districts. When you look at lines 1.16 through 1.19, you quickly realize that the QComp program is not available to a large portion of our students or our districts. It's limited by, it's capped, it's a capped appropriation. It's also subject to a grant program, thank you, as if it's a grant program to those districts that qualify. And so that's the reason it should not be in the general education section of the statutes. Now, so far, I think it's been about four times when I've tried to do this, and each time it gets defeated. I have nothing against it. I'm not trying to repeal it or change it or anything like that. It's just that it seems like it's much better to organize it the way I have done it here in the bill. So, Mr. Chairman and members, with that, I think I'm going to see if Mr. Nauman is here, if there's something that I missed. And I could go through the proposal section by section if you'd like. Is there anything that you can think of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I think you've covered most of the
main points. Mr. Nauman for the tape.
Eric Nauman on the Senate Fiscal Staff. Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I think you covered most of the technical highlights, but I'd be happy to address any questions if there are any.
One issue that I didn't touch was if you look at the appropriation section, and I know some of the members have concern that appropriations should have the dollar figures filled in. The appropriation section is actually more of a technical thing than anything because, at least the way I understand it, the appropriation section is actually the appropriation section for the whole education bill and not just this particular proposal. So it's it will get filled in as this committee agrees to the final package.
Yes, and members, we're at Section 19 and working off the A1 amendment, and which Senator Stump referred to lines 30 and 31, and forthcoming will be numbers as we further review it. Yeah. Senator Bonhoff.
Just a couple of questions to start. I'm sure it's complicated, so I may have more questions later.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, could I?
Sure.
Missed one part, and that's the repealer section. The repealer section contains a couple of items. One is that it deletes the alternative QComp from the general education statute, and then in the bill there's a new recreation outside of that, and then several of the levies. Do you know which ones?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, section MnSTAT 126C10 subs 34, 35, and 36 are the items that Senator Stumpf referred to. Those are the repealing of the alternative compensation program out of general education. As he mentioned, they are reinstated in the first couple of sections of the amendment. Sections 13A and 13B are the aid and levy split calculations that are done on the operating capital, as Senator Stumpf mentioned. That program is now turned back into a revenue program as it was prior to the 2003 session.
Okay. Thank you.
Sarah Bonner, for a follow-up? We know there will be several additional questions, but perhaps if you highlight sections, we do have runs. We'll distribute those when you would like.
I think, Mr. Chairman and members, I think it's fine to distribute those runs. And then maybe I could just take a minute to explain the run sheet so that as members look at it, they can have a little more understanding.
Excellent.
Of it. Mr. Chairman, as once we get the runs handed out, maybe Mr. Arneson could go through and explain the categories across the top and the different sections of it. So that
okay, the members have them, and we'll have additional copies soon for the public. But Mr. Arneson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So this run basically details the impacts of the A1 amendment on what is in current law as the Safe Schools Levy and components of the general education levies that would be touched by this amendment. For the purposes of reference, I'll just refer to columns by letter. So across the first row of letters A, B, C, D, E, F, and so on, I'll refer to columns in that fashion. So this is modeled for fiscal year 15 on underlying data from the February 2013 forecast. Column A is just a count of pupils. Column B is the safe school, the total safe schools levy in current law. Column C is the equity levy in current law. Column D, operating capital levy, current law. Column E, QComp levy, current law. Column I is a subtotal of levies, inclusive of safe schools levy, equity levy, and operating capital levy. Note that because the A1 amendment rolls the QComp levy out of general education, I've sort of simply transposed column E to the last column in your worksheet, column V. And you'll note that the total levy is unchanged and the district level numbers are unchanged. Beginning in the middle section with column J, the amendment would retain levy authority for districts that are members of intermediate school districts. In current law, such districts have an additional $10 per pupil authority. Given their membership in an intermediate district, we don't change that authority. So if a district is a member of an intermediate, they may still levy for that additional $10 if they wish. Column K is under the amendment, the remaining equity levy. You can see that the difference between column C and column K is roughly $34 million. In equity levy reductions. Column L is the proposed law operating capital levy. You can see that that is zero at a statewide level and zero for every district. Column M, the new general education levy in the total amount of $20 million. And you see district level totals on down the page. Column Q is another subtotal of the proposed law general education levies. Mm-hmm. Column QQ is the new state aid. Harkening back to the summary amendment that Senator Stumpf began with, this $151 million is new state aid. This basically covers the difference between current levies and proposed levies inclusive of the portion of Safe Schools levy that would be replaced by all aid revenue. The third section of columns, beginning with column R, is the statewide change in total levy. Columns S, T, and U are changes in levy, aid, and revenue per pupil. And you can see if I can refer to the section of rows that give the total, and then sort of per pupil average breakdowns by geographic region, Minneapolis-St. Paul, inner metro, outer metro, and then non-metro districts of varying sizes and charters. You'll see the per pupil averages. And lastly, column V, as I noted earlier, is simply a transposition of column E, reflecting the fact that the amendment rolls the QCOMP levy outside of general education, but otherwise leaves it unchanged.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
As members look over that sheet and the information, maybe I could ask Mr. Nauman to kind of give kind of a overview of how this fits into the target that both the tax committee has and the education committee has, because I think one of the common questions is that I get is that, well, is this coming out of the education target or is this coming from the tax target?
Tax. So, okay, Mr. Nauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the total amount that that this committee has received as a target is $486.4 million above the February forecast base. That's probably a number you're all pretty familiar with at this point. In the original target discussions, the number was essentially the governor's number, roughly $131 million lower than the number that I just cited. But during the discussions when the targets were established, the tax committee transferred revenue from its revenue calculations into the Finance Committee, and that target was allocated to this division for the purposes of reducing property taxes. And that extra $130 million is intended for that purpose. It might be worth noting that $130 million, when you run it through the aid payment shift calculations, results in $150 million of property tax reduction. So sometimes, depending on if you're talking about this target as $130 million of aid, you'll use that number, or if you're talking about the actual property tax reduction, it ends up being about $150 million, a little bit more. So that's a worthwhile translation to keep in your head. Essentially, what it means for this committee is that typically this committee usually has what's called a zero levy target. You can't raise more levies, and you need to make sure that the levies stay basically at the current statewide level. In this particular year for the Senate, the targets have set a negative $150 million levy number. So what that means is that the final bill that's produced and the tracking that Mr. Wilms will produce that references the bill needs to show a negative $150 million when the bill gets to the tax committee. So if you raise other levies, you have to make sure that the total net change is a negative $150 million. And that's an annual number, so it applies to the tails as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions. And unless you.
And I believe there's testifiers, so we can have questions. Again, this will be laid over for possible inclusion, and we'll talk more about that at the end of the meeting. For that timetable, but questions right now, or would you like to field testimony? Senator Bonoff.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is with regard to the operating capital levy. Would you remind me, are those levies by referendum, or they're just general levies?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, if Senator Stumpf is comfortable with that. So there is a formula for operating capital. It's roughly about $200 per student, although there are a variety of components inside the calculation, and most notably, it's slightly oversamples school districts that have older school buildings. So there's a building age component to that formula. And then the revenue gets, under current law, split on an aid levy calculation using an equalizing factor. As Senator Stumpf mentioned at the outset of the discussion, this program was previously all aid up until 2003, at which point during the budget reductions of that time, state aid was converted into levy. This proposal reverses that.
And then the other question is, it seems to me with this approach that really the school district shouldn't have much overall change. It's rather how the money's coming. And I just looked at the runs, and most of my districts had literally no change, and then one of them had a significant decrease, which didn't even make any sense. So I'm wondering about that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, I think all districts, if you look closely, should have changes.
But pretty significant?
The variation, I think, is about, if Mr. Arneson was about, the swing is about $40, I believe, on the average. So
281.
Staff tried to find the levies that could be most consistent across the whole state.
Okay. Mr. Arneson, and I think we're referring to the Robbinsdale.
Yeah, so I noticed all the levies for Robbinsdale equaled current law $3.2 million, and then in the proposed law are down to $2.4
million. Mr. Arneson.
When you're looking at the spreadsheet for any district, probably the quickest way to see the revenue change, I mean, there's three ways to look at this. You can look at levy change, probably per pupil is the best way to compare changes between districts and to some sort of state average or median. So levy change per pupil would be represented in column S. So that's levy reductions per pupil. So in Senator Bonhoff's example, District 281, Robbinsdale, page 3, levy change per pupil, $201.71 levy reduction per pupil. You can see, if you read two more columns to the right, that for virtually all districts, the total revenue per pupil doesn't change. The revenue change per pupil is zero, except in those cases where a district had not previously been levying their full authority on safe schools.
Right, and they go up. So that's why I'm saying this doesn't make sense to me, Mr. Arneson, because if you look at for Robbinsdale, the total levies except QCOMP are 3.2, but then if you go to the new state aid, it's 2.4. So what am I missing? Because it says the revenue aid is equal per pupil.
Mr. Chair and Senators, in column R, you'll note that column QQ and column R for most districts are the same number. So in your case, District 281 Robbinsdale, column R represents the total change in levies, $2.4 million in levy reduction. That is offset by the new state aid shown in column QQ, $2.4 million.
And Mr. Arneson, then what is the B plus C plus D levies except QComp 3.2? What's the difference between the 2.4 and the 3.2?
Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair and Senator, roughly $800,000.
Right. So why does that show up as a difference there, and it doesn't show up when I move over columns? So here it's saying that all those levies they currently get equal 3.2, yeah, and that the new state aid is 2.4. But then if I go over, it's saying there's no difference, but I see that difference. And so why is it reflected in one part of the spreadsheet and not the other? Perhaps.
Current, Mr. Chair and Senators, current law levies $3.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
Proposed law levies shown in column Q, $774,000. Mm-hmm. The difference between that is the levy reduction.
I got it now. Thank you. Okay. Because you added the 773 plus the 2.4, which equaled the total. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stump, you specifically mentioned in the equity levy there that that would not be part of the general formula, the replacement of that. Does that mean that the other items do become part of the general formula, or are they kept out of that as well?
Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, again, Eric Nauman on the Senate Fiscal Staff. I think the way to think about this is that the equity formula had a component of it that was $46 to every school district in the state. So multiply the $46 times your pupil units, and that's the revenue a school district got. A component of that $46 was imposed on levy, and Senator Stump's proposal was to essentially convert that into all aid and then impose a general education levy of a very small amount at the end of the calculation. So one choice could have been to put that onto the basic formula allowance, but that would have driven revenues to compensatory sparsity and transportation sparsity and increased the operating referendum cap. I think what putting words in your mouth, but I think the thinking was that this was intended to be a property tax reduction proposal and not a revenue proposal. So the only way to accomplish that without driving the money to remove the levy component is to create a separate category equal to $46 times the pupil units and not put it on the basic formula allowance. So normally you would create a component of general education because you're trying to accomplish a particular policy goal. In this case, the policy goal is to pull it off of a formula that has evolved over time and then convert it to all state aid. And that's the reason for making that change in that way.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Weber, if you look on in section 5 of the bill, you'll see that new basic supplemental revenue created. And then if you just hold that and you go over to section 10, you'll see that on clause F and G, that portion is deleted. So what is going on here is that we're creating that new supplemental basic supplemental revenue program that the $46 million or $46 per pupil is in, and deleting it from its existing place.
And so, Mr. Chair,
Ms. Snow.
The other point that might be worth bringing up here is that there are other components of the equity formula that are still on that aid levy split calculation, and this was the mechanism for removing a portion of it and leaving the rest of it intact.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But then relating to the other levies there, besides the equity level, do any of those numbers wind up back into the general formula?
Mr. Chairman, no.
No, okay.
Sarah Dames, did you have your hand up?
Nothing for it.
Oh, okay. We do have testifiers that would like to offer guidance, and we'll go to those. I have listed Brad Lundell, Sean Sprinov, and Valerie Wolstead. And you all may approach if there's room. And if you have handouts, please forward them to us so we can distribute them. Welcome, and state your name for the tape.
My name is Sean Springup. I'm a little bit nervous. I've never done this before, but I appreciate you hearing me. Good morning.
Welcome. You'll do fine.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I'm a parent from the Cambridge Isani. We moved to Isanti in 2000, and in 2003, my daughter, Brett, started school. 2 years later, my youngest daughter, Blake, did too. Since that time, Cambridge ISANI has experienced a number of financial cuts. I do believe the district has done as good a job as they could with these cuts to try to minimize their impact. However, their hands were tied, and they were forced to make some very difficult decisions. Some of these cuts have been significant that most people are aware of. These are just a few of them: industrial technology, the media specialist, the art specialist, the automotive program, the agriculture program, veterinary program, fifth grade band, marching band, social workers, school counselors, family consumer science program, medical terminology program through Pine Tech College, the dance team, and numerous more. Other cuts many people aren't aware of, and I have only learned of them recently, like the student council stipend, increase in activity fees by 200%, increased parking fee, reduced the number of allowed middle school athletic contests per sports, increased the price for individual, family, and student pass fees. We decreased our custodial staff, and we no longer even pay for subs if a custodian is unable to work. Again, numerous others. No matter how big or how small these cuts have been, they have all affected our children. It's getting to the point where there is very little to cut anymore, and any further cuts will greatly impact not only the student, their education, and their future, but our communities and our state's future as well. You know, I just couldn't understand it. When I was in school, our state was considered one of the best of in education. We were the model for other states to follow. I don't ever remember going through financial issues that our schools are faced with. I didn't go to a large school. In fact, most people would consider it relatively small. I had 127 in my graduating class. But even though we were small, we had plenty of opportunities. There were multiple sports from seventh grade and up: band, marching band, jazz band, choir, FHA, OEA, DECA, industrial arts, home ec, yearbook, school newspaper, dance, and many other activities. About 2 years ago, I went to an all-day seminar on Parents United for Public Education. They helped educate me on the educational funding and the history of funding in the state of Minnesota. Last year, I also went to meetings with SEE, Schools for Equity in Education. There, I learned about equity funding and equity-poor districts. I guess I understand a little more now why some schools are in the dire straits they're in. I am outraged, and that's why I'm here. I can't believe that our state has become as complacent as it has. It is our children's constitutional right to have a free and unified public education. The system we have right now is broken. When 93% of the schools need to have an operating levy in order to operate, and the 7% other 7% are continually unsuccessful in passing one. The system we have right now is divisive. I ask you, what is unified about our schools when there are schools that offer Chinese and Spanish immersion for elementary students, current technology in the hands of all students, being introduced to musical instruments at a much younger age, the ability to enrich and extend their students' opportunity with STEM programs? What is fair that our students don't even have art? What is fair that they are not given the opportunity to learn a musical instrument? What is fair that they are not exposed to the latest technology? What is fair that they don't have a media specialist? What is fair that they don't have industrial technology, family and consumer science, and an automotive program? Most importantly, what is fair that there are 10 school districts in our state that can't even afford to open their doors 5 days a week? I understand that all school districts are not equal, but fair is not equal. Fair is fair. We are just asking for our fair share. I urge you, please support the general ed levy and all the children in Minnesota. Oh, yes, that school district that I was so proud of, the one I wanted Brett and Blake to have the same opportunity as, is Brooklyn Center, a school that's in statutory operating debt because they cannot pass a levy.
Ms. Sprinham, thank you very much. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name's Valerie Ralston. I'm also a mom and a wife, and I've worked as a special ed para for 15 years. I've been involved with my school district, Columbia Heights, since I was a student. Similar to Sean, I had a great experience. I have three children now. Two of them which have a learning disability just like I do. I could not read and spell when I was young. I got the help I needed to get into college and become a productive person. Now I can work in the classroom to help the students move forward, and I want the same for my kids and for all the students of Minnesota. And right now, as a para, I'm not seeing that happen. When I started, we had over 60 paras in our unit. Right now, we're probably around 30. And a little history with my two. My middle child, they're 4 years apart. My middle child was able to, she got on a individual educational plan in sixth grade. By eighth grade, she was out. She was off it. She got the help in the classroom. She got the support staff in the classroom. She's a ferocious reader as a young adult now. My oldest son is a senior in high school, was not able to get that extra help because things were getting cut. So he is not reading at a 12th grade level. He's not getting the support that he needs in the classroom. One teacher cannot help 30 to 40 students in a classroom when they have a learning disability. So the students hadn't decreased, and in our district, they have been creative with getting grants. And we have also passed our levies. We have a city that supports our schools. But those grants are going away. They're getting harder to fight for. So all this unreliable funding, we cannot depend on local taxpayers and the good skills to get these grants. We need something that's stable and equitable. The funding that the state is providing, we cannot count on. This isn't just a problem where I work and live. We all know that this is happening in schools across Minnesota, and we need to do something about this. That is why I support the general ed levy. This is our opportunity to bring back stable and equal funding for our school districts. Again, to make Minnesota that great educational state that we were. This is our chance to support every student in Minnesota. The general ed levy is a strong, smart, and forward-thinking way to get our schools back on track. That is what Minnesota is known for, being innovative. And perhaps more importantly, to keep our schools on track instead of education being the political football every 2 years. We need fairness, not cutting down the dreams and the futures of our children. So I ask you, will you fight to invest fairly and adequately support every student in Minnesota with a stable revenue source? Or will you continue leaving our schools and our children to be tossed back and forth like a football? The general ed levy is our best option to help every student in Minnesota and to become the great state of Minnesota in education. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olstead. Audience, we'll like to refrain from applause. We appreciate all the effort and passion into the testimony, but we just have that as a rule. Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity and Education. Just wanted to say, come up here with some brief comments in general support of what Senator Stump is trying to do. The elimination of the general education levy back in 2001 for fiscal year 2003 has created a system that has been very unstable. And as we've talked about, and I know that the studies that have been done in the last few years talk about how we've fallen behind inflation in terms of what we're providing schools, and that's forced more schools out for referenda. And that's a very random and inequitable system in the referendum, and I think having a general ed levy in place is certainly something that needs to be investigated, and certainly Senator Stump has been consistent in this with his talk about the consolidated levy in previous sessions and with this proposal here today. My only other thing that I would say is that this needs to be a piece going forward, and not we don't view this as the total solution. Senator Stumpf has taken the $150 million and put it onto the levies that all districts face in an equal way. Part of the problem that we have is that in low property wealth districts, as we want to get away from reliance on the referendum, but if the referendum is going to be a tool that's going to be used by school districts, that has to be addressed as well. And there's Senator Scoy has taken a little different approach and talked about referendum equalization. It's not an either-or, it's a both-and. And I think that, obviously, resources dictate where you want to put the money. But we need to talk about the difference that exists in school districts and narrow the difference as well. This creates some property tax space for districts, but they'll be going to a levy, having still utilized a levy where some districts have a distinct advantage over other districts. So it's a very complicated system. We think stability and equity are things that go in common. Senator Weber, to your questions about the equity levy, I was instrumental in creating the equity program. I think the equity program, as it exists right now, is just a haven of mischief, of formula mischief. Okay. And we need to really take a look at that formula and totally redo it. You know, going forward, maybe we can get some things that will really, again, look at the gaps that exist between school districts and narrow those gaps as opposed to just having formulas out there that people can fiddle around with. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lindell. We also have Scott Kunquist from AMSD and Jim Bartholomew requesting to testify. And if there's anyone else, please let us know as well. For the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Scott Kunquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And we certainly appreciate Senator Stumpf's work in trying to bring some stability back to the system. And this is a creative, I think, way to do that, to get at that without causing property tax increases. I think that's been the huge challenge that policymakers have wrestled with, is to try to figure out how to move back in that direction without having spikes in property tax increases. As Senator Stumpf mentioned, this was something that the Commissioner's Funding Working Group, Education Finance Working Group, wrestled with, and they did have a recommendation on reestablishing the general education levy. And it was combined, though, with a couple other proposals, and in fact, a couple that you've already heard. And really, if you would take Senator Stumpf's bill, Senator Scoy's bill that you heard last week on the 300 roll-in, and then an amended version of Senator Bonoff's bill establishing a location equity levy by rolling a little bit of more of the referendum, you would kind of come up with what the recommendation was from the Commissioner's Funding Working Group. And so we would still encourage you to look that way in bringing all of those together so you have a balanced package that's going to meet the needs of school districts throughout the state of Minnesota. But we certainly appreciate Senator Stumpf's hard work on this and his dedication to trying to restore some stability to the system. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Kunquist. Mr. Bartholomew.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And we also appreciate Senator Stumpf's efforts at trying to find ways to reduce property taxes. I'll focus my conversation on the recreation of the general education levy specifically. And in short, as Mr. Lundell mentioned, the general education levy was repealed as part of a set of 2001 education and property tax reforms. And at the time, the function of the general education levy was simply to raise property taxes to fund a portion of the basic formula allowance. With the reforms, the formula allowance is now fully funded through state aid. And while a general education levy that may be recreated at $20 million may start relatively small, history tells us that the general education levy will grow significantly. In fact, when the general education levy was repealed, it raised $1.3 billion a year in property taxes, about a third of the basic formula allowance. When the legislature repealed the Gen Ed levy, it accomplished two goals. It provided substantial property tax relief, and it improved transparency in school funding by eliminating a general purpose state mandated property tax. In addition, it should be remembered that the 2001 reforms created what is commonly referred to as the statewide business property tax, a tax that currently raises $800 million a year for the state's general fund. Did the general education levy reduce funding disparities between districts? No. It only funded a portion of the basic formula allowance, revenue which districts already received on an equal basis. Did districts rely less on referendum levies when we had a general education levy? No. I think in your packets you have a one-page handout with some charts. And on the front page, you'll have two charts, and the top chart shows the percentage of school districts that had a referendum, and the bottom chart shows the trend in per student funding.
Excuse me, members, we're referring to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you can see, and the funding is general education revenue without referendums. And as you can see, there's basically a parallel between the two trend lines. There's not a consistent correlation between state funding and district referendums. It is interesting to note on the bottom of the second page of the handout, the rise in district referendum requests following the repeal of the general education levy and the resulting property tax relief. And in the bottom boxed chart, you can see levies and then how they were cut with the 2001 reforms. And then the red line shows the state authorized levies, and the blue line shows voter approved levies. And at the bottom chart just shows you the 5 years in which the state witnessed the highest number of district requests for referendums. And you'll notice 3 of the 5 years are in 01, 02, and 03. The years in which the general ed levy was repealed and the state had substantial property tax relief. That's all meant to say that we're not opposed to referendums or anything else. It's just at that point, local voters had a chance to vote on the levels of their property taxes as opposed to a state-mandated general ed levy. Finally, the portion of district general fund revenues that are supported by referendum levies is not significantly different now than it was when we did have a general ed levy. Referendums represented 9.6% of general fund revenues in 2002 and 10.7% in 2012. And should this pass, whoever's here in 15 to 20 years, I think we'll witness what we've witnessed in the late 1990s, and one of the reasons why we repealed the gen ed levy. The gen ed levy will eventually divert state funding from the classroom to property tax relief. When we had a gen ed levy, and you can see how it tracked on the top chart of the second page, over the years as the legislature increased the general education levy, property taxpayers would get upset. And the legislature would respond by providing property tax relief. Often this relief was accomplished by buying down the general education levy. What this meant for the K-12 finance division is that you'd have a target at the beginning of a session that you could spend for K-12 education. Unfortunately, because of the need to buy down property taxes, you'd use a portion of that target to buy down the general education levy, and then whatever remained was able to go into the classroom. And at the end of a legislative session, the legislature would say that K-12 spending went up by $600 million, for example. But districts would argue that funding to classrooms increased by only $300 million because the other $300 million went to buy down the general education levy. No one was particularly happy, the legislature, school districts, and people in the public were left confused. Was it 600? Was it 300? What exactly was going on? In summary, we'd encourage you not to pass Senate File 1142 and specifically the general education levy and recreate a statewide property tax. First, a general education levy will add costs to employers in addition to the current $800 million statewide business property tax. And second, history tells us that a general education levy won't reduce funding disparities, it won't reduce district referendum levies, and as a state-directed property tax, it will only grow. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Ms. Walstein.
Hi, Amy Walstein. I'm the Director of Education and Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just wanted to briefly state the Minnesota Chamber's concerns with the bill. While we appreciate the property tax reduction that's accomplished through the levy consolidation reductions, we continue to have concerns with recreating the statewide general education levy while the statewide business property tax is still in place. As Jim kind of went through the history of what had happened in 2001 when that property tax came on statewide for businesses and the gen education levy was reduced. And I think it's yet unclear how the mix of this new proposal will impact commercial and industrial business property taxes. Some of the tax capacity questions I think are still unclear. So we look forward to receiving more information about that as this proposal would go through this committee, the tax committees, and how the whole package is put together. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walstein. Is there anyone else in the audience that Ms. Kelleher?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I would like to thank Senator Stumpf for his leadership on this issue. I vividly remember my present boss sitting at this table, pounding on the table, saying, don't take away our statewide property tax because it provides stable funding for schools going forward. And unfortunately, we didn't heed him and didn't listen. But we've now come full circle to realize that it is important to have a stable, ongoing funding source for K-12 education. And Senator Stumpf has led this charge. It's been not very easy some years, and he continues to come back, and it really feels like the right time to do this. So thank you, Senator Stumpf. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Ciccone, Parents United for Public Schools. I certainly cannot do as eloquent a job as the parents who came forward and spoke to you. But what I do want to point out is the repeal of the general ed levy was done, yes, to buy down property tax because the state at the time had surplus dollars between 1995 and 2000 with the largest surplus ever recorded. That's why the general ed levy was repealed as a way to give property tax relief. And Mr. Bartholomew said that now schools are fully funded by the state. Oh, if that were only true. The truth is that by repealing the general ed levy, we've handcuffed school funding to the appetite of state lawmakers to raise state taxes. And that appetite has not been particularly robust in the last 10 years. I do want to say that I agree with Mr. Kroonquist that we absolutely need the general ed levy. We need to buy down property taxes, and we also need to pick up the other components that were that the commissioner's group spent 2 years devising. And I just want to point out that in 2010, the number that was used by the Minnesota Management and Budget Office was for every dollar of state funding that went away, not just for schools, but for all our state needs. 67 cents came back in local property tax. We know why property taxes have come up, and we also know why we can't fulfill what we need to fulfill. This is a blatantly unfair system, and $1.3 billion in general ed levy did go away. And now we have $1 billion back in school funding, but in a very disequal way. Thank you, Senator Stumpf, for your leadership here. We absolutely need a general ed levy.
Thank you, Ms. Ciccone. And again, we appreciate your being here, but please refrain from applause. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stumpf, I am reading Section 7 in the bill, page 3, subdivision 2F, the use of the Safe Schools revenue, and I'm quite concerned about that language. That language was not presented to the policy committee, one. And two, this is a significant addition to the use of the Safe Schools revenue to pay for the cost of basically law enforcement services by the schools. And I would like to hear why this was incorporated. I am quite concerned because I know that Senator Johnson and others in our committee have worked very hard to increase funding for counselors. This was a very significant year in the state to really address issues related to mental health. And we made a commitment to many groups that we want to increase funding for counselors and mental health providers because we see the significance of really providing more resources for kids in those areas. But we did not hear anything related to law enforcement, and I'm quite disturbed by these languages.
Excuse, members, this is I believe it would be a conversion from levy to revenue. It's a restatement of current statute, and then it would look at Senator Johnson other ideas that are being presented as we roll out the overall bill. So I don't think there was an unintended consequence by Senator Stumpf, but go ahead, Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman and members, and Senator Therese Ray, if you look on page 7, section 18, you'll see the same language that is actually stricken and reinstated in section 7 that you mentioned. So this is actually, it's in current statute, the language that you see here.
Yes, Senator Sray.
Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for that clarification, Senator. I didn't know that. Could you tell me if we have, Senator Stumpf, if we have a sense of the current use in terms of kind of proportions that districts use for these type of activities?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Treasury, I believe just for your information, if you look at the spreadsheet, the handout that we have, currently I think there's a handful of districts that do not levy for the Safe Schools levy, and you'll pick those up under the column U. So if you go down that column, you basically can see those districts that are not levying currently for that money, which is most districts do, but there are a few that do not. As far as what most schools use that for, I would say it's probably varies from district to district. I don't have a real read on, maybe someone from the Minnesota School Boards Association would have a better handle on what most schools use the Safe Schools money for.
Okay, I believe Ms. Kelleher will give a quick response, and there can be follow-up with more detailed information on the utilization. Ms. Kelleher?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Stumpf. How we spend our Safe Schools levy, especially in light of Newtown, we spent some time asking our members what they use it for. And I do have that data. I'll be happy to share that with the committee so you can go through and look at their uses. We had over 600 responses from school board members, which is amazing. This is a issue that's really important to them, but oftentimes it's there for law enforcement programs in our schools themselves. So that's usually the best use. But certainly they have interest at expanding that too, Mr. Chairman. But as I said, I'll be happy to share that with you, and you can look at the data for yourselves. It's pretty impressive. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Senator Torres. Right. Anyone else like to address the committee? Well, Senator Stump, thank you for your continued efforts in this area. We have one additional testifier. Hi. Please state your name for the record and welcome.
Yep, thank you. My name is Erica Zidane. I also am a Cambridge Iciani resident. And just one quick statement. When that man was speaking very nicely about the businesses and not wanting to raise taxes, the first thing that popped in my head is, where do his kids go to school? Because they don't go to school where our kids do. He's in the Minneapolis, Edina area. Am I correct? I would love if my kids had what his kids have. I don't want all of it. I just want it to be fair.
Okay, and I think we agree it shouldn't be based on zip code, and we actually started our session talking about the Constitution and when Minnesota, and we're going to continue on that. So,
thank you.
Okay. Hi, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for our tape.
My name is Janet Work, and obviously I've never done this before. The only thought I had is, of course, I totally agree.
And where are you from?
Oh, Cambridge Iciante.
Okay. Senator Nienau has got a lot of constituents here.
You have no idea. We are very, very dedicated up there. And on an off note, we have a petition that has started, and like within 7 days, we already have over like 130 signatures supporting what we're doing, and we're continuing to get more of that. We have a great support system out there. But the reason I wanted to say something is that you're getting lots of perspectives from parents that talk about what our kids are missing and all of that. And I agree wholeheartedly. I don't think you need to hear that again. The thing I want to point out is that everything that you see in the political environment, and honestly, I like to stick my head in the sand and not pay attention to it if I can help it, because it gets to be so overwhelming. But you see things all the time. Keep the jobs in America. Buy America. Support your companies by giving them opportunities to build their businesses in your community by tax breaks. All of these things to keep the jobs in America. How can we continue to do that if we cannot provide the employees who can support those jobs? How can we sit there and say our kids are not worth the education or cannot get the same education as other countries, as other areas, and expect them to compete in the job market? If you're not giving them the opportunities in high school, like all the other schools or different states or different countries, how do you expect them to go to college and get an education that allows them to be competitive in the job market later? And so I'm really think that we have to keep in mind that we're not just talking about arts and music and giving them opportunities. We really are saying we need to support the kids, give them the same opportunities to explore in high school. And that's the point. You explore so many different things so you know where you want to go and continue your education and be competitive in college and get into those good schools so that you can go compete in that job market, and we can keep those jobs in America, and we can have good employment opportunities for our own children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You did an excellent job.
Thanks.
And I strongly believe we all share that goal, and it's how do we get there. So, Senator Stump, thank you very much. And to testifiers, we'll lay Senate File 1142 as amended on the table for possible inclusion. Next, Senator Jensen. PSEO funding changes, and I believe you have a couple of testifiers that may join you at the table. And if there are any handouts, those should be distributed now. Welcome, Senator Jensen.
Thank you.
The handout.
Yeah, they should have the handout.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today to talk about Senate File 609. It deals with post-secondary enrollment options. Minnesota was the first state to enact a post-secondary enrollment program known as PSEO. It was created in 1985, and it was a means to promote rigorous educational pursuits and provide a wider variety of options for students. Through PSEO, high school students receive high school and college and university credit for college or university courses that have been completed. It has many benefits. Most participants say that they learn more than they do in high school. They save time and money, and they feel that they're more academically prepared for college. Minnesota is now one of 18 states that have a comprehensive program. And what that does is allow students to enroll in post-secondary courses at no cost or minimal cost. It permits course credits to be applied to both high school and to the post-secondary institutions, and contains few restrictions on eligible courses for student enrollment. And according to Minsky, that our program provides control to students, provides generous financial support than other states. The way that that happens, though, in Minnesota, is that the money follows the student to an education provider other than the school district. Under Minnesota's program, the appropriate proportion of state aid is removed from the school district when the student enrolls in PSEO course, and the funding is then moved to the post-secondary institution where the student takes that course. Many school districts have responded to PSEO by developing their own agreements with the post-secondary institutions, and they provide college credit courses within their school, so it's a college within the school program. So PSEO has also helped to encourage more vigorous academic pursuits. For more than 20 years, Minnesota has given students the chance to take those at no cost. It remains popular, but what's free for families comes at a price for the school district. And with declining enrollments in many schools, PSEO has become a significant financial concern for smaller districts. There was a change in the 1990s that gave a small portion or a small percent of that money that gets moved over at 12%, but with the way that levies are working and some of the situations that districts are in, this is becoming actually a critical issue for a lot of smaller schools. I have with me Norty Nelson, is a superintendent from International Falls, and he can speak specifically to what's going on in his school district.
Yes, welcome, Senator. Superintendent.
Good. Thank you very much, Senator Jensen, and welcome, everyone. Thank you for your time this morning, and appreciate the willingness to listen. I am superintendent at International Falls Public Schools, International Falls, Minnesota, quite a distance from here. But it's a somewhat of a remote community.
Superintendent, how far is it?
Roughly... Round trip, 640 miles, so roughly 350, 340, depending on which track you take. But, so it's quite a distance.
Yes.
We have a community up there, around 6,000 community members. Our school population is around 1,200 at K to 12. And we do have the campus there, the two elementaries and one high school. Sitting within two blocks of the high school is Rainy River College, and with that, post-secondary enrollment options, a tremendous plus for the families, for the students to earn their credits, their junior and senior year and what have you, and to go on then to some of the post-secondary schools. Financially, it's a real plus also for the families I mentioned and for the students, and you know, maybe through their career getting things completed a little earlier than what they some others can and so on. But with that, we have a little over 30% of our seniors, a little over 30% of our juniors enrolled in that Rainy River College that just sits two blocks from the high school. And they're enrolled full-time. They're completely removed from the school campus, the high school campus. They do come back for our extracurricular activities, things like this. But when they you see the students, sophomores, juniors, and seniors passing in the hall, boy, it's pretty quiet. Then they have grade 7, 8, 9 passing in the hall. You can see there's a number of students. And so it really makes a difference with the number of students gone out of the high school campus. And so the issue that we face is the loss of state aid dollars from those students not attending the regular high school curriculum. And so with our enrollment up there, plus 30% in each of those grades that we see going over to the Rainy River campus, it's roughly 300 to 350,000 each year that the school district loses in those state aid dollars which follow the students. And it's, like I said, it's a tremendous boon to the families, to the students, and so on, but it's sure a hardship for the local school district there, especially with the Rainy River College sitting within two blocks of the high school campus. And so we're not able to really reduce out any staff. We need those staff members there for the other classes, grades 7, 8, 9. And then we also run the same classes, 10, 11, 12, through all the math classes, all the sciences, upper science, upper math. We offer all those, and it's very difficult to maintain those number of staff with roughly 60, 65, 70 students, juniors and seniors, leaving the high school campus. And so the request here that you have in front of you, hopefully everyone has a copy, is the local option for the school board to recoup some of those dollars through the local levy, and just to hopefully address some of the costs that we're dealing with the revenue not coming into the district because of those students leaving the campus. So there's a number of items of information here. We have other districts that have a few students going, but they have to travel, they have to drive. So it makes it a little more difficult for those students. But with the campus, college campus sitting right next door, the students travel over there and can't blame them. But, and it's supportive up there. It's, you know, nobody's hassling that issue, but it's just the loss of $8 that we experience. So if you would consider that as portion of this entire bill, we'd very much appreciate everything that you could do for us. So
thank you, Superintendent. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen, could you take us through kind of the thought process on why you've restricted this to districts fewer than 3,000 RMCPUs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, absolutely. We targeted some smaller school districts because of the equalization that we've included in this bill. There's a fiscal note attached as well, so you can take a look at that. But the idea is that if the burden is, you know, obviously quite larger if you're a smaller district and you have, we pick 20% of your students that are leaving, that's a large proportion of your state aid that you're missing. So we needed to find a way and at least have the conversation on how do we help those districts that have smaller amounts of students, so they have smaller aid already, and that they're losing a higher percentage that are going to the post-secondary and taking those options to make sure that it doesn't harm the district disproportionately than across the state.
Senator Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen. And I, you know, I understand the 20, you know, the concentration of PSEO students in that regard, but proportionately, wouldn't it be the same burden for any district if they had 20% or more students in PSEO? So you're just going to lose that much more revenue as a percentage of what you, you know, what your aid is in the first place. So in other words, whether you're small or large, 20% is 20%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, the difference is in the amount of state aid you're getting in total to begin with if you're a smaller district. So the impact is greater, and that's why we've concentrated on those schools that have smaller numbers of students, smaller aid, and a larger concentration of people that are choosing those post-secondary enrollment options.
Follow-up, Senator Peterson, then Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, proportionately, though, Senator Jensen, it's It's not, because my district that has 36,000 pupils has that much more effort required to educate the same amount of students. So, yeah, they receive more revenue, but they're still losing 20% of, if that's the number, 20% of their revenue, or 20% of their students in those programs, and reduced proportionately in the same way that a district with 3,000 would be. So, in my district, for example, we have an issue with low property wealth. We're very large, but it requires a lot of effort for our property taxpayers to make up for lost revenue, especially as it relates to other areas of the Twin Cities. So I guess what I'm getting at is this would be useful, and I understand why you would want this, but it would be useful for all districts, I think, in equal proportion. I understand if the 3,000 mark is just simply to keep the fiscal note down. If that's the case, then, we can just state that for the record. But I'm just trying to figure out why this option isn't available to all districts. Is there another reason that I'm missing out on other than the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, this bill is being produced so that we can have this conversation about the difficulties that the districts are having with this particular situation when students, we want that option available. So we will continue to have the conversation. This is the direction that we chose to start with. But.
Thank you. Senator Bonhoeff, and then we'll get to Ms. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, this is a complicated issue. One thing is last year we actually, and Senator Olson, worked very hard to expand PSEO, and we put 10th graders in PSEO as well, and this bill, for whatever reason, I think is juniors and seniors, but which I don't understand. But with regard to the 3,000, I do understand that because I've often thought, it costs, there's a certain amount of money it costs to just open a school and have the basics covered, have all the teachers there and the various course offerings. And so whether or not, we fund on a per pupil basis. And so you've got your fixed costs, whether or not you have a certain number of students or not. And so with regard to the fixed costs, it's pretty tough when you're a tiny school and you lose per pupil funding because your fixed costs you still have to maintain. And when you're a larger district, your fixed costs are less a part of proportionally in that way. And so I do understand that. What I myself am quarreling with regard to your bill is that we're now charging our parents for this college education. And the whole idea of PSEO is to give our young people a chance to get college credits without placing a burden on the families. And so by creating a mechanism that levies their property taxes, in the essence, we're making those families bear the burden of this early college education, which is kind of the antithesis of what PSEO is about. So I guess I'd be more open to this conversation if we were talking about state aid and then really looked at what that costs. I don't know if we could afford it or not, but I object to the automatic levy on families for this program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoeff, the reason that the fiscal note is what it is because we've added in aid to that levy in this bill.
Oh, can you describe that, please?
Mr. Arneson.
This, Mr. Chair and members, this proposed levy would be equalized such that relatively lower property wealth districts receive a greater proportion of the replacement revenue as aid, and relatively wealthier districts would pay a greater proportion of the total revenue via local levy effort.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, it still is saying that. Yeah, so I don't think that really addresses the issue I raised.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Jensen, I really support your idea, and I think that this is a very important issue, and I appreciate that you brought this forward. We are moving, as you know, very aggressively in this direction of encouraging parents and encouraging kids to take these credits. And I don't want to see schools, thinking, well, if you go, then I lose money. So we're competing here for you and your resources. And I think it is imperative that we fix this. And, you know, obviously we, you know, we take care of our districts as they are shaped. You know, in smaller districts, you have a district where, you know, this is significant because of its size. So I think it's a good beginning of a conversation. Clearly, I think Senator Peterson has a good point. We need to figure out, you know, in proportion, 20% for a larger school, of course, will be very significant as well. And I would be, you know, reviewing that for larger schools, of course, like my district. But I do think that this is absolutely essential, and I do think that we need to look at how do we connect with higher ed to be able to bring those resources that we allocate to higher ed to pay for part of this, because I think that what is happening right now, although our budget is bigger, and Senator Bond always reminds us of, you know, how significant our budget is and how we need to pay from, you know, our sources. Still, the you know, the college credits, I think, need to be paid in the college context, and maybe we need them to preserve the funding for the schools. And so that might be, you know, a conversation that we need to explore in the future about adding resources to the higher ed to pay, because we do want kids, we do want parents to pursue this. And I think that having this scenario that you describe is an ideal thing for Minnesota, where all of our, you know, juniors and seniors are going to the college across the street is fantastic. So I think that's a good thing, and we need to help you grow that.
Thank you. Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I want to thank Senator Jensen for bringing this issue forward. Superintendent Nordy actually really talked about International Falls, but I'm from a place called Albert Lea, which is on the southern part of the state. And we built our new high school right next to our community college with the thought that we would enhance opportunities for kids. And Senator Torres-Rae has been a leader this year on making sure kids have a college-ready perspective. So we're really sort of shifting in our mind from a test mentality, if you don't pass this one test, you can't graduate from college, to how do you want to shape your future? What classes do you need to do? What would you like to achieve? And that's done in the education policy bill. So I think it's a real encouragement to do even more of what we're doing for kids. And my kids were fortunate enough to take advantage of this. The numbers we've got right now in the state is about 6,254 kids that are taking part in PSEO. We also have concurrent enrollment. It's a separate, and it's even larger. It's about 30,000. And it costs about $25 million right now to do that statewide. This bill would ensure the kids that leave and get to go to the technical school get a great education, but this is also about the kids that don't go. And this would ensure that their options are kept open and their variety is kept open. And you want to encourage it on one hand, but you don't want to decimate what's left for those who don't want to make that choice or might not be ready to go there. So we really think being, you know, getting kids and families thinking about the future and how they can best utilize those high school years is critical for student success. And this bill really does tie up nicely with your education policy bill on that college and career readiness. So I want to, once again, thank Senator Jensen for her hard work. It's a tough bill to read, but when you really think about it, it sets the table fairly for kids. So thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have to respond to the point made by my friend, Senator Bonoff, because I think the principle of what I'm laying out is important for all districts. Relative to the point about fixed costs, that may be true, and it may not be true. Your cost basis for fixed assets per pupil unit is relative to the efficiency that those assets are used. And so if, you know, every district may or may not be efficient with those fixed assets and therefore may have higher or lower cost basis for those fixed assets. So, for example, if you have a building that's 50% to capacity, the fixed costs per pupil unit are higher, and they may be lower if you're at 100%. So it's not necessarily the size of the district as it is relative to fixed assets and fixed capacity. So that's my point.
Noted.
Is there anyone else I would like to testify on Senate File 609? Not thank you to the testifiers. Senator Jensen will be laid over for a possible
Chairman.
Inclusion in the
Thank audience. You, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senate File 673, Harambe Community School, and that would be my bill, and Senator Johnson will.
Chair, do you have an A1 amendment to distribute?
Senator Uyghur.
Yes. Madam Chair, going to get, I have an amendment. I believe it's being distributed.
The A1 and amendment.
And Senate File 673 would transfer the Harambe Community School to the Roseville School District, Independent District Number 623. And I have a technical amendment that was suggested. And I would move the A1 author's amendment.
Okay. Senator Uyghur moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 673. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment adopted.
And, Madam Chair, members, as I indicated, this would provide for a transfer of the school, and it would go to the Roseville School District. I have the superintendent of schools for Roseville, John Tyne. My right will be testifying, and then we have a parent with a few children, I believe, at the Harambe School, and he'll provide testimony. And I'll disclose, when I chaired the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale School Board back in the 90s, prior to going to the Senate, I was involved in the formation of this school in a joint powers with St. Paul and other suburban districts. So I wanted to disclose that. Mr. Kent.
And we have here Mr. Tyne, Superintendent Tyne.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Tyne. I'm Superintendent of Roseville Area Schools. And I'm in your packet, you have a form indicating the rationale for the proposed bill. And I'm not going to go through it, gratefully, line by line, but I would like to ask you to consider the end result, and the end result that Roseville Area Schools is interested in the EMID families, happened to be the transfer in ownership and management and operation of Harambe Community School to District 623, as outlined in House File 833 and Senate File 673. There are a couple of main reasons why we are very interested in doing this. If you're familiar with Harambe and also the East Metro Integration District, it's a collaborative of 10 school districts that joined together to serve the integration needs of the east side of the metro, very similar to WeMet on the other side and the Northwest Integration District. A couple of the main reasons why we're so interested in seeing this transfer take place basically revolves around the students and the families that are served by Harambe right now. You may be aware, and it explains in the documentation that I provided, that this school, the schools in this district are closing. And because of that, students and their families are going to be placed in a position where they have to look for other educational alternatives. And the hardship that it creates is one that, as you have probably know, when a school closes, it puts a family at really in a difficult position. They have to look for a new site. And this is especially true with Harambe because it's a unique program that's offered in the East Metro. It's an environmental science program. It's a year-round program. And it really causes hardship for the families and the students to have to relocate, and there is not an equivalent program on the east side of the metro. The goal of Roseville Area Schools is not to change the program, but to maintain the program, to not only welcome the families that have been would be displaced, but to encourage them to attend. And our door is open. And this is only not only a benefit to the students and the families and the program that's so unique, but also to the staff members. There are a number of staff members who, if those buildings close, if Harambe closes, are going to be put in a position to be forced back into member districts. And that is going to cause a loss of positions within the member districts. At the current time, there is no opposition to this bill that I am aware of. We have the East Metro Integration District has held hearings on it during the closing. The transfer proposal has met with support from all. There's been a dissenting voice. It has also been introduced at our school board meetings, and there's been public comment at our school board meetings and has received support. There is no cost. There are no fiscal notes to this transfer. And again, it saves the students, the families. It saves jobs. It continues a program, a superior program, and it's a wonderful year-round option that Roseville Area Schools and students and families in the East Metro deserve to see maintained. And I will cease my comments and allow another testifier to speak, and I will stand for questions later if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent Tine. And yes, we have Mr. Boguszewski.
Well, we say Boguszewski, but that's pretty close enough. Mike Boguszewski.
Good try.
It only took me about 10 years to learn how to say it. Well, thank you again for the opportunity for letting us speak on this today. I live in Roseville, so I live in the district that Dr. Tine is superintendent of. And we've had kids in the EMID schools for almost a dozen years. Our son is an alum. Our daughter is an alum of Harambe. And actually now, Senator, is at Crosswinds, the other school within the East Mentor Integration District. And so I speak for myself as a parent, and frankly, I think representing the other parents. We've had a lot of meetings on this over the last year or so. Since we learned that the legislative funding for the integration mandate would be going away, and what do? We've shared in the angst of the EMID board itself as to what to do, and we think they came to a good conclusion when the board itself voted to do this and also pursue the transfer of Crosswinds to Purpich. It's a unique district that parents feel sometimes at a loss to work with because it doesn't have its own board. Our board is made up of one representative of each of the districts. And so those folks have a foot in two camps. Not specific to this bill, but on the Crosswinds issue, I think that issue is raising itself now in terms of, you know, is there a conflict between an EMID board member and what's best for the school and a home district? But that set aside, as John mentioned, there have been numerous public hearings both around with the EMID board that many parents have come to support this concept and within the Roseville School District board with parents coming to support the concept. I think one of the things I'd like to talk about just a little bit is getting into that uniqueness that John mentioned. In addition to the environmental science focus, the magnet focus, the year-round calendar, maybe most importantly, and it's the I part of EMID, is the culture at Harambe and Crosswinds that's really a model of voluntary integration, real integration, more than just throwing a bunch of kids who look different and act different in a box and shaking it up and expecting something magical to happen. It's a culture that's very intentional. It's very intentionally driven by the leaders and the teachers that all parents respond to, whether they are parents who are non-white or non-traditional themselves or whether they may be, as many of our parents are, white parents who've adopted children of color or have ethnicities. And if you visit these schools in Harambe, you'll see it's a culture where kids actually choose themselves to eat together, to play together, to spend their time together, to become friends and BFFs, regardless of what category they fall under. And, you know, certainly there's a category like skin color, but it's also a category which may be an ethnicity that's separate from a skin color. I grew up as a Polish kid. Or there's an ancestral heritage or first language. I think right now a little over 25% of the kids in Harambe are ELL students because of a first language that they speak different than English at home. Or it may be a learning style or communication style. Our own son had issues in a traditional neighborhood school with his learning style, how he communicated. Or it could be more particular special learning needs, actually diagnosed medical or physical things that kids have to deal with. Or it might even be across the district, and we see this too. Maybe it's a child who simply has discovered a passion for something that's not typical And it's not shared with the kids in the neighborhood schools and isn't understood in the neighborhood schools. And where Harambe and Crosswinds have made intentional decisions to concentrate their budgets more on things like science labs and art studios, there's no hockey rinks and, you know, locker rooms. That makes it a little different, too. So I guess the point is it is unique in a lot of different ways. It's not just another neighborhood school. Everybody hates it when their local neighborhood school fails or risks closure, and they march down here with pitchforks and everything. But it can't be handled at local level because of the district. It is a legislative involvement, and I think the parents are aware of that. That's why many of us are here and have stayed very involved. But the integration piece is key. That's the real mission. True integration is that all these kids across all these categories live and work together and play together and don't have to accept the notion that the category that they belong to is a more accurate predictor of their success in school or success in life than their own innate potentials and abilities. Harambe has been the only option for a lot of the families who recognize that their kids need that environment and would not thrive, or in some cases may not make it at all in the neighborhood schools. Over the last year, we've heard powerful testimony from other parents who I am very good friends with. Now, also, you know, there are kids at Harambe who could make it at any school, but whose families chose EMID because they value their children spending their days really living in that culture. I believe Harambe right now is just about 50-50, right? White, non-white. And like I said, mixed up all else, too, in terms of free and reduced lunch and special learning and all of that. It's also, you know, from a parent's perspective, and I know you guys care about this, as I've been hearing on the testimony of other bills this morning, it's really kind of I think it's an efficient model. You can't do all these programs spread all over the place. So this is really a destination of choice for the families who need them. If Harambe and EMID didn't exist, most of these families would not be able to just be absorbed back into the neighborhood schools. They'd be looking at charter options or special school options, other things like that, just because the resources are spread too thin to really, you know, make it universal. And that's the key role that Harambe plays within the geography. It's got room for 450 kids in what is now going to be, I think, a 7,000-student district, and had been serving the larger 100,000 East Metro District. That's a very particular role that it plays that we want to keep alive. Harambe and Crosswinds aren't a threat. They're a treasure for these districts, for these kids and these families to go to where there's really no other option. It just can't be replicated in the neighborhood school system for these kids who aren't under the large part of the bell curve. So that's why I, and I think the parents also, Fairleigh University, do support and hope you will also support the transfer of governance to the Roseville School District. Both Dr. Tyne and the Roseville School Board see the value in that role. They want to keep the role of Harambe intact. They want to keep that soul of Harambe intact. They don't just want to snatch the body of the building and repurpose it for something else that is totally divorced from the original integration mission that was attached to the asset. I think that to us is the key, is what John and the district want to do is keep that role, turn it into a learning lab. Let's take a look at what works there for these kids and why and how, and then disseminate that teaching through the other schools in the district, teach the teachers. It's kind of ironic because all those years ago when the districts got together and formed EMID, they recognized that. These schools were specifically created as an alternative for just the families they've been serving. And now that specific funding is going away, there is a sense of desperation, I think, to keep Harambe and Crosswinds alive. And maybe one final comment. You know, we're here today. Many parents are involved in this, but it's not just about saving the school, I guess, for those of us who are there now. These kids are always going to exist. It's keeping this model alive and this framework and this program alive for future kids. In a state where, let's face it, especially in the metro area, in the first and second collar suburbs, kids of ethnicity and racial diversity are increasing dramatically in terms of the percentage of the kids in the school. So if we don't learn from places like Harambe and Crosswinds and keep them intact and be able to disseminate that knowledge out into the rest of our schools, we're going to be a pretty sad, sorry state. And Minnesota's proud tradition of leading the nation that was talked about earlier today in education is going to suffer even further. So I think I and the parents implore you to approve this transfer of governance. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that completes our testimony. I'm not aware of any opposition. Because this facility was funded through the state, it would need to go to our Capital Investment Committee to sign off on that. And so at some point I'd make a motion that'd be recommended to pass to the Finance Committee for re-referral.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. And question, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wieger, is there's some discussion about Crosswinds as well. Are these the only two schools that are under the control of the East Metro Integration District?
Superintendent Time.
Madam Chair. Senator, yes, these are the only two buildings that are operated by the East Metro Integration District. Member districts are, you know, separate entities, but there are 10 member districts. 8 of the districts send students to Harambe, and I assume Crosswinds, but I'm focused on Harambe right now.
Madam Chair and Superintendent, the role of East Metro Integration District goes beyond these two schools? Do they have other responsibilities?
Madam Chair?
Superintendent Thine.
Yes, Senator, they do. They offer unique services such as staff development, curriculum. Example of one program that they support is a AVID program for our students of color and first-generation students to enter that would be entering college. It's a unique program. They're very influential in that program and very supportive, along with a number of other options and programs.
Okay.
Superintendent, is the school, is it K through 8, or what is the enrollment?
Madam Chair, the building right now, Harambe, is a K through 5 building.
Okay, 5.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, if I may add,
yes,
it would continue that way. We'd assume in the documentation that talks about it that the students that are there already, the staff that are there already, probably the only thing, as I mentioned to parents, that you'd notice is that the sign on the outside of the building would say 623 rather than 830, you know, 7, whatever the number, 607.
607.
Yeah, I know 623. That I do know.
And another question from just myself. How many students are at that school?
Right now there's about 425 students.
Okay.
And we would look to probably make that a K-6 building. And the reason we would do that, it would fit with our structure. And it would also allow students that are there the opportunity to continue one more year in an option. And also it would be to grandfather in, or grandmother in, as I say in the paper, all the students that are currently attending and also staff. This is a, if I may elaborate, this is really a win-win situation, not only for Roseville Area Schools, but the primary focus is the students and the families and our staff. And the wonderful program that's there, it's unique, it's special, and as Parent Bogoshevsky mentioned, it is an absolute learning lab for our students and for the entire East Metro Integration District.
One last question from myself. Where do these students go back to their resident districts?
Madam Chair?
After the fifth grade.
Right. They have the options of going either to any one of the 8 districts they could go to. Many of them make the choice to go back home, some their home district. Some choose other high schools. We have students that might be from, I'll pick on Stillwater, and they may go to our middle school and then go back to the high school in Stillwater eventually.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Senator Wicklund.
Chair Johnson and Senator Wieger, I just have a question. It's kind of a technical question about the transportation. In Subdivision 5, it talks about the board may transport pupils to and from the school. And I understand that that's part of the current arrangements, but it also looks like in your materials that new open enrollment students, it would be treated as open enrollment students, and typically they don't receive transportation. Is that, could you clarify, is it the case that once you're admitting new and open enrollment students, that they would be responsible for their transportation?
Superintendent Thine.
Yes. That's the intent. Eventually, what would happen, they'd be grandmothered in. But as we transport students, right now we have an agreement with 622, which is the Senator's home district. We transport students through an arrangement with the Minnesota Department of Education. We pick up students. They open and roll through our district so that they can attend Harambe. And we have students, as the bus goes through, there are families who are allowed to ride the bus. We don't receive support for them. We'd continue to do that as long as there were students that were grandmothered in. So I hope I answered that. The answer is yes, but we would attempt to provide, make sure that they're able to attend if there's a SIB.
Senator Weaker.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 673 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to finance.
Okay. Members, you've heard the motion from Senator Weaker. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion passed.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, please. Go ahead.
Okay. We have Senator Claussen next, Senate File 1477. Senator Claussen, we have your bill, Senate File 1477.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and thank you very much for the opportunity to meet with you today regarding Senate File 1477. Senate File 1477 proposes to create a new separate appropriation that will enable school districts to carry out the teacher development evaluation mandate through an open appropriation. We all want great teachers in our Minnesota schools. To accomplish this goal, we also need a teacher development and evaluation program that will create great teachers. In 2011, the legislature passed a required teacher development evaluation statute, and that statute does have merit. There's no question about that. The Minnesota teacher development evaluation law is quite prescriptive, and yet funding for the program does not follow the prescriptive nature of the law. And this is going to be an expensive mandate because of the related costs associated with the law. I believe you have a chart that's been put together that kind of looks at the components of the teacher evaluation law in QCOMP. If I could have you kind of turn your attention to that.
We have that in our packets, members, I believe. At least Senator Weaker did.
We tried to do here is if you look at that chart on the left-hand side, to take the major components of the teacher evaluation program and see how they mesh up with QCOMP. And then you'll note that underneath each of those major headings, for instance, if you take the first one, individual growth and development plan, you'll note that there are a couple of items that are in italics. Those are specific items that have been taken out of the teacher development and evaluation program. So they try to mesh with those components and then trying to compare, are they found in QCOMP as well as in the teacher development evaluation program. So if you look at that, there needs to be funding to train personnel to conduct the summative evaluations. There needs to be funding to train teachers and provide release time to perform peer reviews. We need to train teachers and principals about the evaluation system. We need to pay for expenses related to release time for teacher evaluations. There are going to be expenses relating to the training and release time for effective professional learning communities, implementation requirements relating to student longitudinal achievement data will need to be accomplished, implementing requirements related to the student engagement data, the evaluation provided by students, and then developing and maintaining a teacher evaluation data system. So all those things are in the bill. All those things need to be accomplished. If you look down below on that chart that you've been provided, the governor's recommendation for the teacher development evaluation program, it's approximately $10 million. $1.4 million for Minnesota Department of Education to develop a model, and then also to provide some test sites that will be implemented next year, and then 8.6 for non-QCOMP school districts for full implementation the following year. In other words, $8.6 million is in the governor's budget to implement the teacher evaluation program, but those dollars will not be going to districts that have the QCOMP in place. So the total budget proposed for teacher evaluation is approximately $10 million. That's about $22 per student, but you need to really look at the number of teachers to be evaluated, because there are teachers that might be on a 0.4 contract, a 0.6 contract. They may not be full-time teachers. So you really need to look at the number of teachers that are going to be evaluated. And then as a comparison, if you look at the QCOMP budget, it's $260 per pupil unit that's allocated. Annually, that's about $75.6 million. We serve 137 school districts, and of that $75.6 million, there's still $10 million available for additional school districts to implement QCOMP that has not been allocated at this time. So at present time, there's no dedicated funding to pay for the teacher evaluation activities. We do have a proposal in the governor's budget, but there's been no allocation. And today you're going to be hearing from Minnesota School Boards Association, Education Minnesota, and others on projected costs during their testimony. If we really want to ensure high-quality, accurate, defendable evaluations, we need to appropriately fund the process, I believe. And that's what this bill is all about. And at this time, I'd like you to hear from some of our testifiers today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Claussen, and we do have two more people who have asked to speak more than those that are listed on the agenda. So we will need to hurry along. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I think it's important for you to understand, I also want to thank, before I get there, is thank Senator Claussen for bringing this forward, because it's one of the issues from our membership that we heard throughout the fall season and rolling into the school year as well, that this is one of the uncertainties going in on the funding piece and the training requirements that go along with it. And I think it's important to understand that it's an age-old truism. You can't separate policy from funding. And I think that's what happened last in 2011 when they passed the teacher evaluation piece, was a major state policy initiative. And then as we get closer to the implementation phase, we are seeing the piece that perhaps is going to cost school districts. In fact, based on our estimation, will cost school districts additional money in terms of required training. So I think it's important to understand also from a board perspective and administrator perspective, and there'll be some folks here who will share their on-the-ground experiences, but grade evaluations do matter. I mean, I think they matter to parents, they matter to board members, they matter to administrators, and they matter to teachers in terms of ramping up and providing skills and training for our teachers who instruct our students. Now, the bill before you assumes, and I think it's very important to understand that it assumes that districts will automatically be going into a default program, the state default teacher program. Under the proposed law, school districts and through their exclusive reps can, through a joint agreement, agree to a teacher evaluation system. But if there is no agreement, then what happens is the state law requires a state-mandated teacher evaluation piece. And so the part that I'm going to highlight are the costs associated with that piece. And I think it's important that when you talk about time, when you talk about training, when you talk about removing teachers from the classroom for training or to provide peer review, that costs districts money. I think that's important to understand from the ground perspective. Some of the things in the default plan that require peer review, which generates district expense in terms of training, release time, and hiring substitutes for school districts. And so, or you could certainly pay teachers to work outside of the basic day. The amount determined based on 10 reviews at a half day per peer review was approximately $5 million. The default plan requires a student learning goal. Those areas where you don't have an MMR measurement or an MCA measurement, those are pieces that in those non-evaluation areas require student learning goals. So those require development and retention as well in there. That will cost school districts. The development plan requires teachers to develop individual growth and development plans, to participate in numerous points of contact, self-reflect, all of which would require time perhaps out of the classroom or time after the school day, release time as well, which would also cost school districts. The default plan requires the use of a student survey that has not yet been developed. And I think that that piece also is not a part of the QComp strategy as well, but the student survey will be a component of the teacher evaluation, which has not been yet developed. And so that piece will also require development and implementation costs as well. I think one of the more important pieces is one of the cost factors that we look at, and the MMB came out with a number of approximately $80 million in terms of a cost when this first came out. And that was based on an 80-to-1 ratio of teachers to a summative evaluator. So you have peer reviewers, and you're going to have summative evaluators in this as well. So you're going to have more than just one administrator doing this. And so I think it's important to understand that you're going to have teachers who will be removed from the classroom to be trained to do the evaluations. And so that all of those pieces provide costs. So working with Ed Minnesota, they came up with a number looking at a more reasonable number that we thought would be more practical to do a much better job and to lower that ratio to 60-to-1. And that's where a big cost driver is going to be for districts, is to look at those that ratio of a 60-to-1, where you have one summative evaluator for 60 teachers. We feel that's much more reasonable. And so when you look at that total cost, employing a summative evaluator at that ratio, you're talking about $110 million. So that time out of the classroom, also perhaps hiring substitutes in the training as well. The other major cost is the establishment of PLCs. Now, part of the challenge with coming up with costs here was the fact that school districts are in different phases of their teacher evaluations. Some in the QComp, other districts have already forged ahead before this statewide requirement came forward and have been doing this. But based just trying to assume that, try to get a good solid number, that's what we're looking at. Another piece that we're considered is looking at the establishment of PLCs, or professional learning communities. While many districts have these, there are some districts that do not use those. And so the establishment of PLCs, whether it's based on content, grade level, organization, however you want to do that, that also would require time out of class or perhaps time after the contract day. And what I want you to leave with is that certainly the governor has proposed some revenue for school districts, for those non-QComp districts. There are provisions that require QComp. There are going to have some additional requirements for QComp districts, and there are going to be many more requirements for school districts that may not have a teacher evaluation program established. Now, they certainly do for their probationary teachers. I get that piece. But it may not be as aggressive or may not be as prescriptive as lined up here in the bill or the state law, I should say. Lastly, I just want to end with, we know that there's going to be a pilot program coming forward here. And the department's asking school districts now to pilot either parts of the statewide default program or a comprehensive review. The challenge is that they do that in 2013. The piece comes back. The data comes back in June of 2014 when school's all done, and school districts are expected to have this ramped up on July 1, 2014, ready to go. So we're hopeful that perhaps looking at more time to look at the data that comes back from the pilot sites, that school districts, rather than jumping into this while flying the airplane or building the airplane while they're flying it, I think it's important that we have a time to reflect. Are there pieces in the state statute that need to be amended or need to be changed so it's more reflective of the reality that's going on in school districts? So the cost driver is certainly one, and secondly, more importantly, is the implementation of that piece as we move forward. And I think that the important number, an important number to come up with is, and remember, this is a default model that, assuming everybody's in there is looking at approximately $289 million when you start talking about removing teachers, training summative evaluators, training principals as well that we're looking at. So these are real costs, real issues for school districts that they're going to have to deal with at the ground level. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Halschwager and let her share.
Senator Peterson, I know you had a question. Would you like to ask it now or
wait? Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Snyderwin, you had mentioned the fiscal note from a couple of years ago. Did I catch you correctly at the end of your statement there that MSBA has calculated the cost to be $289 million?
We have worked with Ed Minnesota and MSBA, their staff, who are actually at the training today, have come together and worked with other fiscal staff from the other body to look at the costs per teachers, the hourly time, the half day time. So they've really gone into the weeds. And again, this is assuming that you go to a default program. And I think we just don't know where everybody is. And I think that was a simple solution to find the cost drivers, assuming that they go there.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So was that an MMB fiscal note, or that was something that your organizations did kind of collaboratively?
Mr. Schneiderwind.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, is the piece is that this is something we have worked with, and I don't believe that there's been an official documentation on this piece. Perhaps Ms. Halschwager can say, I don't think there's an actual fiscal note, but we feel very confident in those numbers that they looked at, the hours, the days, the training requirements that go along with that.
Just one more comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
I'll be quick here. So just for the record, there was an actual MMB fiscal note done on this, and you're correct in pointing out that it was roughly $80 million. You talked about the 80-to-1 assumption on evaluator to teachers. Grant you that you may reduce that burden by or increase the burden by 25-30% if you go to 60-to-1. What you failed to mention, though, is that in that very same fiscal note, the assumptions by MMB were on three evaluations every 3 years or one per year by a trained evaluator. The law only requires one summative evaluation, as you know, every three-year cycle. The most significant cost driver of the evaluation program is the trained evaluator and having that staff and taking the time to do those evaluations. So to, you know, that in my mind would reduce that number from $80 million to what I've figured was $40 to $50 million is a legitimate number, still considerably more than the $10 million that you guys are proposing. I understand things cost money, but to make the jump to $289 million, I think, is highly questionable based upon the actual fiscal notes that have been produced by MMB on the issue and what we know about the law as it compares to the assumptions made in that original fiscal. And I think it's important for members of the committee to understand that there is a great disparity in some of the assumptions that are being made on the costs. I don't dispute that there are costs, and I've even acknowledged that the costs are significantly more than the revenue that's being talked about here, and I think that's a valid point, but I just wanted that to be stated for the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Halschwager.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Halschwager, Education Minnesota, and I'll address some of your comments in my testimony. Education Minnesota 2 years ago in 2011 and over the years has said over and over again, we want our teachers to be evaluated. We want great teachers in our classroom. We are very open, willing, and ready for a good evaluation system. We want to keep the great teachers. If there's teachers who need improvement, we want them to receive the support that they need to improve. And if that doesn't happen, there are times when teachers should be terminated. And I just want you to know that our union presidents work with administrators all the time to get ineffective teachers out of the classroom. I just need to say that. I do have a couple of handouts. And so I'll ask the page to pick this up. And as I'm waiting for the document to be distributed, I just want to remind people that the law before this was passed, and I give Representative Peterson some credit for all of his work on teacher evaluation. But before that, the only requirement for evaluation in law was for the probationary teachers for 3 years, three times during each of those 3 years, to be evaluated. And once a teacher received their fourth contract, they received what we call continuing contract status, or what often people call as tenure. Now, there wasn't a requirement for any evaluation after a teacher receives continuing contract. But I want to make it clear that districts all across the state had policies and processes to evaluate teachers. Very different in some districts than others, and even if a district had a policy, it could be very different in one building than the other. And, you know, administrators, I will say, even as a representative of teachers and non-licensed school staff, administrators have been burdened with a tremendous number of evaluations. Think of a principal who has 20 probationary teachers in their building, which is not unheard of. That means 60 evaluations in 1 year. And that doesn't even count the other policies that they'd have to implement to evaluate teachers who are beyond that. I also want to note that I give the commissioner, Commissioner Casellas, credit in that when this law was passed, there was no funding to even put forth to prepare the state model. So the commissioner went out and got grants from private foundations, businesses, et cetera, so that they could actually do the work to prepare the state model. And then that's what we have in front of us. I would also remind people that with the MMB fiscal note of $80 million, that was done very quickly. And as I understand it, based on one district and taking it statewide, in rural Minnesota, you have very different needs than in Senator Hoffman's district. Anoka is the largest school district in the state. They are a QComp district. In rural Minnesota, you might have your curriculum director really be the first grade teacher. A fifth grade teacher might be the assessment coordinator. Your high school social studies, in addition to providing the instruction in that area, could be the athletic director. It's Senator Dames knows that it's in rural Minnesota, they have a lot of extra duties. And so that's why this funding becomes very important. The document that you have, it has some yellow highlights, is the law that was passed. The yellow highlights indicate the areas that we feel, that I just looked at quickly, that said this is the cost that Mr. Schneiderwin talked about. So once this law is passed, we have an obligation to do it well. Education Minnesota, I should have had this other document passed out as well to the page. I've got another document.
Excuse me, Ms. Olschwiger, we are supposed to quit at 11 o'clock, and okay. We will very close to that time. We have two people from somewhat out of town, St. Francis and Parker's Prairie, so it would be probably
okay, I will,
polite to let them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will conclude with just showing Education Minnesota's commitment to getting a quality teacher evaluation plan. And this backs up what Senator Claussen has said and Mr. Schneiderwin. If you look through this document, you will see the various requirements in the teacher evaluation plan that are very good. Many of them are very good requirements, but they will take a lot of time. It'll take a lot of funding, and this is just a resource for you. And I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair, because of in the interest of time.
Thank you, Ms. Olschwiger. And I think we'll wait with questions until we get done with the testimony. Mr. Ames, Superintendent from Truman and Parker's Prairie.
Thank you for having me. Yes, I'm Tom Ames. I'm the superintendent in Truman, Halftime, and Parker's Prairie. The other half of my workload, I live in St. Charles, Minnesota, where I was the superintendent for 28 years and walked to work every day and home. And now I'm putting on about 600 miles a week traveling between these two rural districts, and I'm proud to work there. I made a phone call to Parker's Prairie. I was in Truman yesterday to the principals, Carrie Johnson at the high school and Darla Harstad at the elementary, called in the morning, said, MSBA's asked me to come up here, testify before you. Is it okay, or do we have something on the docket that would prevent that? Mrs. Harstad called me back at 5 minutes to 6 last night. She was still in her office. She said, Tom, they were lined up out the door today. Rural principals and rural teachers, in many cases, work very hard. Mrs. Harstad is an excellent principal, one of the finest educators I've ever worked with. She works hard in terms of teacher supervision and evaluation. My question is, how are we going to, in these rural districts, comply with the evaluation law for teachers without additional funding, resources, or help? What would she have taken out of her busy day to work with peer coaches or add another PLC? Mr. Tate Drome, the principal in Truman, is a K-5 or a K-12 principal. Mrs. Johnson at the high school is flat out. So I think we are committed to improving the quality of instruction in the classrooms. And I myself, during my 28 years in St. Charles, taught 2 hours a day. I believe in quality pedagogy. But I think to implement this law, to improve teaching, we need to go beyond the resources that we currently have to be in compliance. I have some problems with the law, the focus on evaluation. I believe whether it's the Minnesota Twins and their inadequate pitching staff, to improve them, giving everybody a scoreboard evaluation isn't the way to go. They need coaching. Brick by brick coaching on how to throw that slider, where to put that curveball. Teachers need the same thing. And many of our teachers in Minnesota, or many of our principals in Minnesota, need the kind of training that would allow them to be that excellent coach. Their colleges didn't provide that at the level we currently have. Your law is not going to transform them into excellent coaches. So we need leadership from the Minnesota Department of Education, from the legislature. But the current law, the way it is written, is going to require compliance, and comply we will. I don't think anyone's ever achieved excellence through compliance. And we're going to have to use valuable time out of Mrs. Harstad and the other principals' days and teacher days, and we're going to have to use scarce resources. I walked to Mrs. Harstad's office 2 weeks ago, young man sitting at the table, second grader. I said, how's your day? He said, not good. Got in trouble on the bus. I talked to Mrs. Harstad later. She said, Tom, he doesn't come to school a very happy camper. They don't have electricity on full time at their house. Rural poverty and problems and demands have increased. There's no counselor at Parker's Prairie Elementary School. There's no social worker. That's the principal doing that job. Meeting with moms and dads and community members, dealing with kids, and now we're going to add another thing on that plate. An important thing, improving instruction, and we're all for that. I just have some questions. How is it going to work?
Thank you, Mr. Ames. You make up a good point. Mr. Neubauer.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Neubauer. I'm the principal at St. Francis High School. We're a high school of 1,600 students and a district of 5,000 students. First of all, I want to thank you for your willingness to hear us out today. And actually, I had a little speech ready for you, and I think I'm going to amend that and say, really what we need. Here's what I need, and I want you to know I sat in an evaluation, or an observation, as we would call it, this morning, a teacher's class, and it would have made the hair in your head stand up. It was so excellent and so good. We have such great teachers out in the teaching world, and it's absolutely the best part of my day is to get out into the classrooms. That is the deal for our principal. One of the most important things that we do is provide support and feedback to the teaching process. And we are piloting teacher evaluation. We're always monkeying with it a little bit. We're always trying to make it a little bit better and tweak it, make it more effective, make it more meaningful for our teaching staff. To that end, we're also trying to anticipate what our teacher evaluation will look like in the coming years and trying to marry those two systems up. This year, we thought with our continuing contract teachers that we're evaluating that we would do drop-in evaluations as well as one formal evaluation. That evaluation will be very similar to what you would think it would be. It's a pre-conference, an observation, post-conference. But to put that together with 10 drop-in observations throughout the course of the year, and that would be our continuing contract evaluation. So if you think of that, we're going to stop into it. For me, it's 7 or 8 teachers. I have 2 assistant principals. They're each doing 7 or 8 teachers, 10 times throughout the course of the year, and then to sit down and have a meaningful conversation at this time of the year, the spring of the year, with them. For our probationary staff, we're doing a 10 drop-in observations. We're doing a formal pre-conference observation, post-conference, and we're having the staff member do a self-evaluation. So those are the 3 components to the evaluative process for our probationary staff. What we're working with now is trying to add the component of data. And that's an important component, I think, because we want to be able to measure student growth and student learning. And in order to do that, one of the needs that I haven't heard spoken of today would be a data coach. We are promoting that our district hire a data coach for secondary education so that they can grind through the data, we can bring them into the conversation, because that's one of the areas I don't know that I have the time to sit there and grind through the data. So that's one of the areas that would be helpful to us. We're working with a vendor who is going to put together or has a software platform that will help us categorize, aggregate data, disaggregate data with regard to the teacher evaluation itself. There's a cost to that. That cost is $40 per evaluatee. And so we're meeting with them next week, and we're going to have to make a decision as a district. Can we afford the $12,000 or so per year that it would cost to be trained and also to aggregate that data and then disaggregate it at the end to determine the effectiveness of a teacher on a continuum? So I would just like to close again by saying thank you for having me here today, and also to comment about data and the importance that data plays in the evaluation process, and then the process itself, which isn't the process that maybe some of you witnessed when you went to high school and saw the principal sitting in, and that's a one-time deal. It's getting into the classroom early, getting into the classroom often, and having meaningful, constructive conversations with teachers. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, we have 2 more people who have asked to testify. So if you can be very brief and succinct, we have Ms. Gelberg from Moundsview School District and Connie Hayes from the 916 Intermediate. If you can certainly understand the time constraints, and I hope that you can bring us some information that we have not heard before. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Sharon Shelberg from the Moundsview School District. I have been in the district 40 years, and so I have seen numerous teacher evaluation systems, plans going through. I speak for the teachers in my district that we welcome this evaluation law. We welcome this system of requirements that we have to fulfill, that our district, in conjunction with our teacher group, are currently working on right now and have been working on since fall to try to come up with all the things that we need to do to meet the requirements for the law. We feel that this law will provide a framework for consistency in our evaluation tools, so that we are designing rubrics. We hope to be eventually next year to be training our principals, our other evaluators, our peer coaches, and also looking at ways to provide more staff development, professional development for teachers who are need improvement. But just from a teacher's point of view, I am glad that we have this law. We do need funding to make sure all the components can be fulfilled and work through. But I think eventually if we have everybody on the same level playing field, we'll have a much better evaluation tool to maintain our quality teaching staff that we currently have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. Connie Hayes, Superintendent, Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate District. I'm here to testify in support of this bill because it does take into consideration the unique needs of the intermediate districts. This bill, in contrast to the proposal by the governor, calculates the amount of revenue available for teacher evaluation based on the number of teachers in the district. We believe this is a more equitable manner to determine across the types of districts, and we feel this better establishes that the expenditures for this program are per teacher, not per student. The governor's proposal, linked to the way QCOMP is calculated based on the number of students in the district, does not work for either QCOMP or teacher evaluation for the intermediate districts. Unlike typical K-12 districts that will have an average of 20 to perhaps as high as 30 students per teacher, the teacher-to-student ratio at the intermediate districts in our special ed programs is much, much lower. Compounding the matter for the intermediates, the majority of the students served in these programs are not even counted at the intermediate district. They are counted as students in their member districts. So if the legislature intends to provide teacher evaluation aid to meet the components of the teacher evaluation statute, we believe it should be based on a fair and equitable manner and based on the number of teachers that the program will serve. Revenue based on the number of teachers is more equitable than revenue based on the number of students served. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. And to all the testifiers, thank you for documenting the need, the challenge. Senator Clausen, would you like to make a couple concluding remarks, and then we'll take this under advisement for possible inclusion.
Well, I think today you've heard what the issue is, and I think we put together a good bill. Everyone has talked about the need for and a supportive of the bill for teacher evaluation. The only question is the funding issue. And quite honestly, I'm not sure how much it's going to take. I don't think we can ask for a fiscal note here from the legislature. I think we need to ask the people out who are being asked to implement this. What is it actually going to cost? I think there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. You talked about data banks of information. We're looking at growth of students over a period of time. 35% of the evaluation is based upon the growth of students of an individual teacher. How are you going to measure that? That takes some expertise. It perhaps takes some technology, data bank of information to draw from. So all these things have to be looked at as you put together the cost of the program, and that's what this bill is all about. I think we need to take a real strong look at what are the actual costs involved.
Thank you. And Senator Dames, a brief comment?
Yeah, just a request. We have a habit around here of using fiscal notes, and so I know that contrary to what your thoughts are, Senator Clausen, I would request that we do have MMB give us an updated fiscal note on this. This might be a challenge for them, but they've done fiscal notes and other challenges. So if we could get an updated fiscal
note. Mr. Wilms?
I think in this case this would be a local impact note as compared to a fiscal note, but we can certainly request one of those.
If you would do that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dames. Sir Curley is an impact. Senator Torres Ray and Senator Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you're pressed for time, but I wanted, Senator Clausen, a couple of issues. I do want to come back to this conversation because I do believe that it's incredibly important. I would have liked to have the opportunity to ask Mr. Neubauer about the issue of, having an exceptional review this morning with a teacher. And being so proud of it, and as a result of it, then what? What do we offer that teacher that is so exceptional after conducting a review and evaluation. I think that what we do is say you're great, and you go back and continue to do what you've done. Interestingly, the conversation around this issue of evaluation and putting a score and putting a number was that we want to act as business. You know, I think that was the conversation we had a year ago, that in business we conduct evaluation of workers and we promote people, actually. Companies say, well, if you don't do well, you will be fired. But if you do well, we will promote you to the next level and we will increase your salary. We don't do that in the schools. And so I think that there is a very important issue here related to why are we doing this? What are we trying to accomplish? If we're trying to help our teachers be better teachers, that's one thing. But if they are doing their work, how do we compensate them so that they can continue to do better and more innovative? And then the whole issue of connecting their performance to a score of a student. It's a very important issue, and it's a very challenging issue because many of the districts that testify earlier and the person who testified before you said, you know, this is a child that is not going to do well today because they don't have electricity in their home. So the score of that child is going to be connected to that evaluation of that teacher. And I don't know if that is fair. So I just wanted to put these elements out because I think no matter how much money we put into an evaluation system that doesn't have the critical components of evaluation, I don't know if money's going to do it. I just wanted to say that, Senator. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. We're going to let Senator Pearson pose the last comment or question.
Just one comment. You know what's actually to aggravate your comments? School districts can't even pay $25 for a plaque to give to a teacher after 30 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Senator Pearson, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I just want to say we've fairly routinely in this committee and the Ed Policy Committee been pressed for time, and I understand there's a lot of work to do in putting together an omnibus bill. I would just request, and I'm sure this is your intent anyways, but that when we get to the omnibus bill, because I have got a list of questions on matters of policy and finance that, you know, I haven't asked that is a mile long. And I hope that when we have the omnibus bill presented, we take the time to get through all of those things. And also on the point about the Twins pitching staff, which he's a gentleman's speaking my language now, I agree that you can evaluate that staff all you want, and we're not going to get to where we need to be. I think most Twins fans would also acknowledge you're not going to coach that staff up either enough to win the division or probably even play 500 baseball. But you can draft the talent, and you can sign the talent through free agency, which I think is what we all agree needs to happen. So,
and to take that analogy a step forward, that's why those first 3 years of a teacher's career are so critical.
Yeah. Senator Claussen, testifiers, thank you. And members, we will meet tomorrow. And we have several bills that are all posted, and we'll use any remaining balance. 1477 be laid over for possible inclusion. But if there are amendments, and Senator Pearson, I'm calling out to you, please share ideas. If there's questions, we can get on the phone, and it doesn't have to wait till we're on the floor. We're at the committee. There's a lot of opportunities to do that fact-finding right now, just as we do in our districts, et cetera. So, excuse me, in the audience, we're not adjourned yet. We are working on the omnibus draft right now, and I would hope that we would be able to meet with our respective caucus groups Monday. I can't confirm that yet, and by Tuesday or so, but there's always different conflicts that are coming up, and I've been setting this date for at least a few weeks. We want to make sure it's ready, but that is the timetable that we're looking at, and we'll wait for further information. If you have a particular schedule conflict, many of you have made a point of always being here, or to let us know if there's amendments, if there's anything that we haven't covered, let us know. And again, I reiterate that if there's a particular item in the omnibus bill, you know the different parts, you've seen the various components, and it's how that puzzle is going to be put together. But if there's some questions on a particular aspect, you know, forward it to staff. They're working very hard. There's various resources here. So, you know, I'll state that. And if there is no further business, our committee's adjourned.